This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Christian Science Monitor Weekly Digital Edition. My name is Daniel Williams. Today is Friday, January 2nd, 2026. And I'll be reading today from that weekly digital edition, and we'll be looking at articles from the News and Middle East sections. We begin with the section titled Global Newsstand. And let's take a look at this. It is numerous snippets from news around the world. The first article comes from the Vancouver Sun, Vancouver, British Columbia. The title of this snippet: People want renewables, but mostly they want energy. Canadian politicians, once mostly opposed to pipelines, are now falling over themselves to promise new gas, oil, and hydroelectric mega projects, writes Douglas Todd, a columnist. Polls reveal a hunger for new sources of energy, especially wind and solar, but also liquefied natural gas, nuclear, and crude oil. In the past 20 years, wind and solar power have been indeed expanding, but coal, oil, and natural gas are not being phased out. Take, for example, China. Wind and solar power now accounts for about one-third of its energy production. China also continues to build more coal plants while expanding natural gas production and escalating oil consumption. Renewables will become more important, yet we must realize there is a long road ahead. Our next short article comes from Al Jazeera. The dateline is Doha, Qatar. The title: Bangladesh's economy is reforming, not collapsing. The recent wave of pessimism surrounding Bangladesh economy under its interim administration offers an incomplete portrait of the country's actual economic trajectory, writes Faisal Mahmood, press minister of the Bangladesh High Commission in New Delhi. The previous administration left behind a financial system propped up by manipulated data and systematic concealment of risk. Bangladesh's inflation is driven partly by lingering market distortions and the after effects of early monetary expansion. It is difficult but not destabilizing. The battle ahead is about dismantling entrenched corruption, extortion networks, and bureaucratic bottlenecks. These are the early foundations of a more transparent, durable economic future. Our next article, it comes from the Daily Star. The dateline is Dhaka, Bangladesh. The title: We need a climate passport. There's historical precedent. There is a small image to the right-hand side of the page here. It is a drawing of a green passport, and it appears there's a yellow symbol. It might be a thermometer or compass on there. And below that compass or image is Republic of India. So let's look at the short article here. When lands become uninhabitable and sometimes disappear underwater, where do vulnerable people go? And under what law, writes Ziba Farrar Haque, a lecturer of law at North South University in Dhaka. Bangladesh must push for a climate passport. It would function much like the historical Nansen passport issued to stateless people after World War I, granting them legal status and the right to cross borders. When entire coastal regions become uninhabitable, Dhaka and other cities cannot endlessly absorb these populations. A climate passport would ensure that losing land does not mean losing identity, culture, or protection. Our next article comes from the Moscow Times. The dateline is Amsterdam. The title, Despite War, Russian Culture Persists. For a time, Russia's publishing industry continued in the face of government pressure, writes Jan Levchenko, a journalist and cultural studies scholar. In the early years of the war, even the text of so-called foreign agents were released without major difficulty. In May 2025, security services raided the parent company of two publishing houses. Three employees were slapped with extremism charges. The war affected cinema, too. But most people involved in Russian film production stayed. The war has even raised the status of some Russian films that are shown internationally. If one manages to say something human in the face of censorship, repression, and war, the value of that message naturally increases. Our next article, Buenos Aires Herald, Dateline, Buenos Aires, Argentina. The title, Home Shows Itself Everywhere If You Look. Now there is an image here, it's an illustration, and it looks like it's a bowl of porridge or some other item here, a soupy type meal that's delivered in a brown bowl. So let's read the article. How do you carry the taste of home with you when home is half a world away? Asked Aditi Shah, a writer. When I left Mumbai for Buenos Aires 3 years ago, I tried to replicate the flavors I missed most. Most days, something was off, until one random Tuesday. I grabbed a plastic container of Eros con leche. When I dug my spoon in, I froze. It was the cure that my mother made. I was overwhelmed by the unexpected gift of tasting home. After that, I began searching for echoes of home in unfamiliar dishes. Slowly, Argentina began to answer back. Every time I found another overlap, it felt like this city was trying to tell me, "You're not as far from home as you think." These articles were compiled by Victoria Hoffman, a staff writer. The illustrations were provided by Karen Norris, who's on the Christian Science Monitor staff. Let's turn the page to page 43 of the weekly edition. This brings us to our home forum section. And here is where we have the games. At the top of the page, we have a crossword puzzle. Beginning with a cross, we have a three-word clue, and it's big dog familiarly. I'll give you a little bit of time to think about that and describe the rest of the page to you. Below that, the second part of the page at the bottom, we have a Sudoku game, and this one is a difficulty of 3 out of 4 stars. And what we do see with Sudoku is a grid with numbers and open spaces there. To the right of that, we have the words questions, comments. Contact us at crossword@csmonitor.com or sudoku@csmonitor.com. Below that, we have a grayed-out box that says crossword and Sudoku solutions. So for that three across, that first three-letter across, and the clue was big dog familiarly, and the word is lab. Now, these clues are provided upside down, and we also have the Sudoku game provided upside down and all the grids are filled in with numbers. Below that, in green lettering, it says how to do Sudoku. Fill in the grid so the numbers 1 through 9 appear just once in each column, row, and 3x3 block. And now we go to page 44. This is our last page of the magazine, and it's a full-page ad, and it's an ad for Smucker's, so I'll describe it. Fruitful since 1897, in lettering across the top, and then below that, in columns of four jars, we have jars of Smucker's dating back from 1897, where we see a very kind of primitive jar of jelly. It has white papering around it and an old metal handle to pick up the jar. And then all the way down to the present. And what we see here is what we get when we go to the grocery store and buy Smucker's. It's a glass jar. There's a red and white striped top to it that you screw off. And then it's the glass jar. You can see into the jar and see those seeds and the strawberry preserves in there. There is a label in the middle of the jar. It says Smucker's. And below the word Smucker's, there are seven strawberries hanging on the vine there. And then below that, in a red little stripe with white lettering, it says strawberry preserves. Below that, we have more verbiage about the advertisement. It says, a leader in jams and jellies for over 100 years and still growing, Smucker's. There are two more strawberries laying on a bed of leaves. And then below that, the J.M. Smucker Company, Orville, Ohio. Visit our website at www.smuckers.com. Let's move to the website now and the news items. Our first article, the title, is Mamdani's Rise Reflected in Muslim Neighborhood That Was Targeted After 9/11. This article was written by Audrey Thibbert, a staff writer, and a staff photographer, Riley Robinson, contributed as well. The article was published on December 30th, 2025. The dateline is New York. At the top of the page, we do have a street image. I'll read you the caption first. People walk in the Bay Ridge neighborhood of Brooklyn on December 11th, 2025. And in this image, it is a streetscape photo. And so right to the left of the image, we see a large sign that says Subway, Bay Ridge Avenue Station. And there's a big R below that. And the R is set in a yellow circle. And then to the right of that, we do see people crossing the street. It's a very busy street. There are cars moving along. And there are two, they look like elderly people. They have gray and silver hair. And they're bundled up. It looks a little bit chilly. And they're walking across the street. And they're heading towards the Bay Ridge Cafe. And you can see that's written in English. But below that, you see the words written in a foreign language. I believe it might be Farsi, which that is written in. But we'll get more into that article. Let's begin it right now. Marwa Giannini was 10 years old and growing up in Brooklyn on September 11, 2001. In the fallout of the Al-Qaeda terrorist attack that killed almost 3,000 people and destroyed the World Trade Center's Twin Towers, she remembers the beginning of intense surveillance and fear in the Muslim and Arab community that followed. And even as a young girl, she remembers thinking that the people who were some were targeting in the wake of the attack needed a way for their voices to be heard. Now, she leads an organization providing that representation, the Arab American Association of New York, and she is at the center of something that might have felt unthinkable to her and others 25 years ago. She's part of the transition team for New York's first Muslim mayor, Zoran Mamdani, who will be sworn in January 1. Mr. Mamdani got nearly 51% of the vote in a mayoral election that saw the highest turnout since 1969, winning a diverse mix of demographics and communities across the city. In Bay Ridge, a neighborhood in southwestern Brooklyn, known for having the largest Arab community in New York City and a significant Muslim population, Mr. Mamdani won the majority of the votes, though the western portion voted largely for former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. At this point in the page, we do have an image. I'll read you the caption first. Marwa Giannini, executive director of the Arab American Association of New York, is part of Mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani's transition team in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, December 18th, 2025. We do see Marwa. She is dressed in traditional Muslim headdress there. She also has a formal gray jacket that she's wearing that has bright gold buttons on it. She has her hands crossed across her chest, and she also has very nicely manicured pink fingernails. She is standing on a street corner in front of the Arab American Association of New York location. It's just a street front there, and there is a glass front to the building with large red flowers painted on the glass. So we'll get back to the article now. Over decades, the Bay Ridge neighborhood has transformed from a former hotspot of European immigrants to a place now known informally as Little Palestine or Little Yemen, especially around Fifth Avenue between 67th and 75th Streets. There, storefront signs are often in Arabic, not English. Recordings of the Quran play on TVs and radios in neighborhood shops, and the call to prayer, or adhan, rings out from the local mosque. In Mr. Mamdani, many New Yorkers see a candidate willing to take on the city's affordability crisis, even as some question whether he can deliver on his campaign promises. For many Muslims in the city, his victory has also prompted reflection on their community's journey from political marginalization to one of their own becoming the top elected official in New York City. The story of Muslim New Yorkers and Arab New Yorkers isn't one of linear progress, says Ms. Giannini. There are a lot of complexities. It's a community that has to continuously fight to feel safe and supported and seen. Mr. Mamdani, while vowing to be a mayor for all New Yorkers, made a direct promise to Muslims in his victory speech, saying the over 1 million Muslims in the city will now know that they belong, not just in the five boroughs of this city, but in the halls of power. The most salient moment. After 9/11, a covert counterterrorism program by the New York Police Department targeted Muslims and people of Middle Eastern descent in Bay Ridge and other communities in New York. The Arab American Association of New York, as well as mosques, students groups, and businesses, were police targets. A 2013 lawsuit accused the NYPD of civil rights violations by surveying Muslims without cause. The settlement led to major reforms within the department, including a prohibition on investigations based on race, religion, or ethnicity, and increased oversight of rules that safeguard against discriminatory and unjustified surveillance. Asad Dandia, one of the plaintiffs, had discovered that a charity he co-founded had been infiltrated by an NYPD informant. He says the case pushed him into community organizing. Quote, "It was probably the most visible and salient moment in our history where we actually took a stand against discrimination and injustice perpetrated by city government," Mr. Dandia says. That momentum continued. In 2013, organizers launched the Muslim Democratic Club of New York to mobilize voters. Mr. Mamdani's chief counsel on his transition team helped found the group. 4 years later, Mr. Mamdani served as canvassing director for Kadir El Yatim, a Palestinian-American and Lutheran pastor who ran for city council in Bay Ridge. Despite El Yatim's loss, the campaign helped activate people there, and Mr. Mamdani's political career can trace its roots to the work he did in Bay Ridge. We do have a photograph here on the page at this point. The caption reads, "Mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani leaves a news conference in New York City, November 20th, 2025. Mr. Mamdani will become the city's first Muslim mayor when he is sworn in on January 1st. In this photograph, Mr. Mamdani is in the center of the image. He has black hair brushed to the side. He has thick black eyebrows, a bushy black beard, and he's wearing a pretty heavy black jacket for cold weather. And in his arm, he's holding a binder with commentary and comments on there. And also, it should be said, he has a big smile on his face. He's looking in a different direction off to the side where his photograph is being taken. This is on a city street in New York, and there are people near him and surrounding him. He's being interviewed. There are people holding up iPhones, videotaping him. And there are other people who are his handlers, it appears, who are kind of hanging on to him and reaching out to others around them. So let's get back to the article. Culturally, the community's story continues to evolve. Just 3 years ago, a woman named Basma, who asked that only her first name be used for privacy reasons, arrived here from Algeria. I had heard people speaking Arabic, and there was a store that had Algerian music playing, and I was walking and crying and laughing at the same time, she says. It's all the same as Algeria, the food, the language, the gossip. At least hear us. Amir Ali, a Yemeni business owner in Bay Ridge, says he is glad to have Mr. Mamdani representing Muslims in public life. It does matter to me to have a nice picture of Islam other than what the media shows, Mr. Ali says. That's what we care about. He is showing the American Muslim as we want him to. But what matters most to Mr. Ali and others interviewed for this story is the issue Mr. Mamdani centered his campaign on, affordability. A poll in early 2025 found that almost two-thirds of New York City residents say meeting basic needs is increasingly difficult, and almost half of respondents have considered leaving the city. Mr. Ali has personal experience with rising cost. He says monthly rent for his shop has increased by around $2,000 in the past few years. A lot of people voted for Mr. Mamdani, not just Muslims, not just Middle Easterners, because all these people are struggling for real with affordability, Mr. Ali says. They need somebody to at least, even if he's not going to fix it, look at it and at least hear us. Next, we come across yet another image on the page. The caption reads, "An Arabic language newspaper at a bakery in the Bay Ridge neighborhood of Brooklyn features a photo of Mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani's November meeting with President Donald Trump at the White House, December 11th, 2025. And in this image, the newspaper is set down on its side, so it's not upright, it's to the side, so you need to turn your head to be able to look at it. And it is written in Arabic, And there is a woman in one image. She has a Muslim headscarf covering her head, and she is holding a microphone and speaking to an audience. And then below that, there's another image, and this is the image described. It's Mr. Mamdani and President Trump, and they are meeting at the White House. Mr. Mamdani is standing. He's wearing a dark jacket and a blue tie and a white shirt, and he is standing next to Mr. Trump, who is seated in front of an American flag, and Mr. Trump is turned to speak to Mr. Mamdani. Mr. Trump is wearing a dark jacket, a red tie, and a white shirt. And we'll get back to the article now. A democratic socialist, Mamdani's agenda includes things such as city-owned grocery stores and rent freezes. His political opponents have seized on that. Yes, he says he's a socialist, says Republican U.S. Rep. Nicole Malliotakis, whose district includes most of Bay Ridge. But guess what, my friends? Those are policies straight out of the communist playbook of Karl Marx. Mr. Mamdani also faces headwinds among other constituencies in the city, which is home to the largest Jewish population outside of Israel. Some of his public statements related to the war in Gaza have been criticized by Jewish organizations and leaders, including when he apparently declined to condemn the phrase "globalize the intifada," a phrase they believe condones violence against Jews. Mr. Mamdani has said it is not language he uses. In an October debate, he said he recognizes Israel's right to exist, but would not recognize any state's right to exist with a system of hierarchy on the basis of race or religion. Still, about one-third of Jewish New Yorkers voted for Mr. Mamdani, and he has said he will be a mayor that protects Jewish New Yorkers. His pro-Palestine stance, meanwhile, has earned support from many in New York, where 44% of registered voters sympathize more with Palestinians, while 26% sympathize more with Israel. This is according to a New York Times and Siena University poll. Miss Janini, a Palestinian American, says it was once unimaginable to her that elected officials in a country that aligned so closely with Israel would publicly express support of Palestinians. Mr. Dandia, an urban history tour guide in New York, who is on Mr. Mamdani's informal advisory team, says the mayor-elect stance reversed the feeling for many voters who had felt politically invisible on the issue. Zarina Gruwal, an associate professor of religious studies at Yale University, says that the post-9/11 period has been a politically transformative time for Muslims in New York City and led to a successful grassroots movement. She says Muslims were the canary in the coal mine for issues such as affordability. It was the social welfare issues of poverty, surveillance, racism, unequal access, discrimination in schools, and health care that really got Muslim New Yorkers to come together despite their political differences and work in tandem with each other and see results, Ms. Gruwal says. Moving to our next article now on the website. This article is titled, My Year Covering the Historic Start of Trump 2.0. This article was written by Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief. She can be reached on X at Linda_Feldman, and Feldman is spelled with two N's. This article was published on December 30th, 2025. The dateline is Washington. At the top of the page, we do have an illustration. We see the author, and she has short, sandy brown hair, and she is leaning her elbow on a desk, it appears, and she is wearing a short sleeve shirt and a necklace and a wristwatch on her right wrist, and she is looking in the direction of the viewer. Behind her are images. Again, these are comic book type illustrations. There's an image of Mr. Trump, our president. He is wearing a suit, and he appears to be signing a document. And there is a piggy bank in front of him. And then we also see other images and a map behind them as well. So let's get to the article. After 38 years as a journalist in Washington, 23 of them on the White House beat, I thought I'd seen it all. That includes covering the first term of President Donald Trump, whose specialty is thinking and going outside the lines. For this past year, it has truly felt unprecedented. For me, it started on Christmas Eve 2024, when I made the first of two visits to the D.C. jail. Outside, I spoke with participants holding a nightly vigil for those convicted in the January 6, 2021 assault on the U.S. Capitol. Their fervent hope that the soon-to-be reinstalled President Trump would pardon the convicts, some of them friends and loved ones of those standing watch. Those jailhouse visits would foretell a year of tumult, of a president who would sweep back into office feeling vindicated and determined to flex his power, shaking up Washington while rewarding friends and punishing enemies. Fast forward nearly a month to Inauguration Day, when the monitor's turn came up to serve in the press pool, and from the crack of dawn to late that night, I had a ringside seat on a signal day for two American presidents, and the duty to write regular reports for the wider press corps. In the morning, we in the pool tracked outgoing President Joe Biden, and at the stroke of noon, we were like Alice in Wonderland, going through the looking glass into the new reality of a second Trump term. In the motorcade, we careened through the streets of Washington, going from event to event, including multiple inaugural balls. That night, in his triumphal return to the Oval Office, Mr. Trump answered the prayers of the vigil keepers, granting clemency to almost all of those convicted of breaking the law in connection with the January 6 riot, nearly 1,600 people. Issuing pardons, an enumerated presidential power in the U.S. Constitution, would prove to be a regular and controversial aspect of Mr. Trump's first year back. So, too, would many other defining features of this extraordinary period, from the widespread layoffs initiated by his Department of Government Efficiency, to the sweeping immigration crackdown, to the disruptive tariffs imposed on nearly every U.S. trading partner. Mr. Trump also took aim at major universities over alleged anti-Semitism. In May, the press pool rotation put me again in the Oval Office, when the discussion turned to Mr. Trump's efforts to ban foreign students from attending Harvard University. I seized the opportunity. Quote, "Why would you not want the best and brightest from around the world to come to Harvard?" I asked Mr. Trump. The president pivoted to talking about how some Harvard students in recent years have needed what he called remedial math. When I tried to nudge him back to my question, he wouldn't have it. "Wait a minute," he said, persisting in his argument. The clip of that Q&A spread quickly. In the end, Mr. Trump allowed Harvard to keep accepting foreign students, then went further. He decided to issue 600,000 visas for students from China, to the chagrin of his MAGA base. American schools, he said, needed the tuition money. Breakfast with Bannon and Vaught. Understanding a presidency and the wider universe of White House adjacent characters requires persistent questioning and close listening. As the moderator of Monitor Breakfast, I had the opportunity this year to host two key figures from Trump World, former senior advisor Steve Bannon and current budget director Russ Vought. Hosting Mr. Bannon for breakfast was controversial, given the MAGA activist's provocative views, including his insistence that Mr. Trump won the 2020 election and would serve a third term, despite the Constitution's two-term limit. But Mr. Bannon also had the president's ear. The day after our breakfast, he spent 3 hours at the White House, including lunch with Mr. Trump. Mr. Bannon was adamant that the United States should not attack Iran's nuclear facilities, but 4 days later, Mr. Trump did just that. The Monitor's YouTube video of the breakfast became our most watched ever, with more than 443,000 views. Our breakfast with Mr. Vought, director of the Office of Management and Budget, and before that, an architect of Mr. Trump's second-term agenda, was less controversial. But, as a key member of the administration, he's more consequential. Dubbed by some the shadow president, he has the power to make things happen, including a number of dramatic cuts to government programs and spending that have occurred without congressional approval. Most memorably, he said this at our breakfast, quote, "The appropriations process has to be less bipartisan." Our YouTube audio of the Vault breakfast didn't come close to the viewership of the Bannon video, but I still recommend it as a path to understanding how this administration operates. Changes to the White House and Washington. As a Washington resident and longtime observer of the White House, I've been struck by Mr. Trump's changes to the building itself. First, there was the addition of much gold filigree to the Oval Office and the paving over of the Rose Garden. More recently, Mr. Trump drew international headlines for tearing down the East Wing to make way for a giant ballroom. I will never forget the sound of jackhammers that grew ever louder as I walked down 15th Street Northwest toward the scene on the morning the demolition began. For weeks, the scope of the project was a point of contention for the president and his chief architect, whom he ultimately replaced. Mr. Trump's deployment of National Guard troops to the streets of Washington was another controversial decision. The president had made the move in August in the name of addressing crime, but like the June deployment to Los Angeles, it seemed largely performative. In mid-September, while walking home one day, I struck up a conversation with a guard member who said he was a police officer from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He had been in Washington 3 weeks, he said, and seemed ready to go home. Quote, "Have you been involved in any police actions here?" I asked. "Nope," he responded. "Been sent to any bad neighborhoods?" "No," he said. "Are there any?" 2 months later, on Thanksgiving Eve, the unthinkable happened. Just blocks from the White House, a gunman shot two guard soldiers, killing Specialist Sarah Beckstrom from West Virginia. The alleged gunman was a young man from Afghanistan who had worked for a CIA unit there during the war and was later granted asylum in the United States. Before the tragic events of November 26th, the news media had often portrayed guard members on patrol here as maybe a bit bored, though at times helpful. Guard troops have been seen picking up trash and helping people carry groceries or change a tire. Since their arrival, crime is down in D.C., but so is tourism. Now, after the ambush at Farragut Square, the National Guard's mission is laden with fresh import. In a deployment that had already been extended to February 28th, Guard members are now all armed. Mr. Trump has ordered 500 more troops to D.C., adding to the 2,000 already there. And he's halted immigration applications for migrants from 19 countries. As the first year of Mr. Trump's return to office comes to a close, I'm reminded that the daily drama that is life in Washington extends far beyond its borders, affecting lives near and far. Our next article comes from the section called First Look. Title is Trump Says Ukraine-Russia Peace Closer Than Ever After Talks with Zelensky. President Donald Trump says Ukraine and Russia are closer than ever before to a peace deal, even as Russia launched another round of attacks on Ukraine while Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky flew to the United States. This article was written by Will Weissert, Sungmin Kim, and Elise Morton. It was published December 28, 2025, and the dateline is Palm Beach. There's a photograph at the top of the page. The caption reads, President Donald Trump, right, greets Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky at his Mar-a-Lago Club December 28, 2025, in Palm Beach, Florida. In the photograph, the two gentlemen are standing with their arms by their sides. Mr. Zelensky is on the left. He has black hair and a groomed dark beard, and he's wearing a dark shirt, maybe a black shirt and a black top. And he's looking over to Mr. Trump, who is talking. Mr. Trump, who's on the right side of the page, he's wearing a navy blue jacket and a blue striped tie and a white shirt. And he is looking at Mr. Zelensky and is talking. You can see his mouth open as he's talking to them. They are standing in front of gilded decorations. There's gold on the walls and golden handles for the doors behind them. Let's read the article. President Donald Trump on Sunday insisted Ukraine and Russia are closer than ever before to a peace deal as he hosted Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky at his Florida resort. But he acknowledged that negotiations are complex and could still break down, leaving the war dragging on for years. The president's statements came after the two leaders met for a discussion that took place after what Mr. Trump described as an excellent 2.5-hour phone conversation with Russian President Vladimir Putin, whose invasion of Ukraine launched the war nearly 4 years ago. Mr. Trump insisted he believed Putin still wants peace, even as Russia launched another round of attacks on Ukraine, while Mr. Zelensky flew to the United States for the latest round of negotiations. Quote, Russia wants to see Ukraine succeed, Mr. Trump said during a late afternoon news conference following the meeting with Mr. Zelensky, whom he repeatedly praised as brave. Mr. Trump and Mr. Zelensky both acknowledged thorny issues remain, including whether Russia can keep Ukrainian territory it controls, as well as security guarantees for Ukraine to ensure it's not invaded again in the future. After their discussion, they called a wide group of European leaders, including Ursula von der Leyen, President of the European Commission, and the leaders of Finland, France, Germany, the United Kingdom, and Poland. Mr. Zelensky thanked Mr. Trump for his work. Ukraine is ready for peace, he said. Trump and Putin will speak again. Mr. Trump said he'd followed the meeting with another call to Mr. Putin. Earlier Sunday, Mr. Putin's foreign affairs advisor, Yuri Ushakov, said the Trump-Putin call was initiated by the U.S. side, lasted over an hour, and was friendly, benevolent, and businesslike. Mr. Ushakov said Mr. Trump and Mr. Putin agreed to speak again promptly after Mr. Trump's meeting with Mr. Zelensky. But Mr. Yushakov added that a bold, responsible political decision is needed from Kiev on the fiercely contested Donbas region in eastern Ukraine and other matters in dispute for there to be a complete cessation of hostilities. In overnight developments, three guided aerial bombs launched by Russia struck private homes in the eastern city of Sloveniak, according to the head of the local military administration, Vadim Locke. Three people were injured and one man died, Mr. Locke said in a post on the Telegram Messenger app. The strike came the day after Russia attacked Ukraine's capital with ballistic missiles and drones on Saturday, killing at least one person and wounding 27. Ukrainian authorities said that explosions boomed across Kiev as the attack began in the early morning and continued for hours. Mr. Trump said, however, that he still believes Putin is very serious about ending the war. Quote, "I believe Ukraine has made some very strong attacks also," Mr. Trump told reporters as Mr. Zelensky stood by his side. "And I don't say that negatively. I think you probably have to. I don't say that negatively, but I think he hasn't told me that, but there have been some explosions in various parts of Russia. It looks to me like, I don't know. I don't think it came from the Congo." Mr. Trump noted that it was possible that the negotiations will fall apart. Quote, "In a few weeks, we will know one way or the other, I think," Mr. Trump said. "We could have something where one item that you're not thinking about is a big item, breaks it up. Look, it's been a very difficult negotiation, very detailed." The face-to-face sit-down between Mr. Trump and Mr. Zelensky underscored the apparent progress made by Mr. Trump's top negotiators in recent weeks as the sides traded draft peace plans and continued to shape a proposal to end the fighting. Mr. Zelensky told reporters Friday that the 20-point draft proposal negotiators have discussed is about 90% ready, echoing a figure in the optimism that U.S. officials conveyed when Mr. Trump's chief negotiators met with Mr. Zelensky in Berlin earlier this month. During the recent talks, the U.S. agreed to offer certain security guarantees to Ukraine, similar to those offered to other members of NATO. The proposal came as Mr. Zelensky said he was prepared to drop his country's bid to join the security alliance if Ukraine received NATO-like protection that would be designed to safeguard it against future Russian attacks. Intensive weeks ahead. Mr. Zelensky also spoke on Christmas Day with U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, Mr. Trump's son-in-law. The Ukrainian leader said they discussed certain substantive details and cautioned there is still work to be done on sensitive issues, and the weeks ahead may also be intensive. The U.S. president has been working to end the war in Ukraine for much of his first year back in office, showing irritation with both Mr. Zelensky and Mr. Putin while publicly acknowledging the difficulty of ending the conflict. Long gone are the days when, as a candidate in 2024, he boasted that he could resolve the fighting in a day. Indeed, on Sunday, Mr. Trump referred multiple times to the complexity of settling the conflict. After hosting Mr. Zelensky at the White House in October, Mr. Trump demanded that both Russia and Ukraine halt fighting and stop at the battle line, implying that Moscow should be able to keep the territory it has seized from Ukraine. Mr. Zelensky said last week that he would be willing to withdraw troops from Ukraine's eastern industrial heartland as part of a plan to end the war, if Russia also pulls back and the area becomes a demilitarized zone monitored by international forces. Putin wants Russia gains kept and more. Mr. Putin has publicly said he wants all the areas in four key regions that have been captured by his forces, as well as the Crimean Peninsula, illegally annexed in 2014, to be recognized as Russian territory. He also has insisted that Ukraine withdraw from some areas in eastern Ukraine that Moscow's forces haven't captured. Kiev has publicly rejected all those demands. The Kremlin also wants Ukraine to abandon its bid to join NATO. It warned that it wouldn't accept the deployment of any troops from members of the military alliance and would view them as a legitimate target. Mr. Putin has also said Ukraine must limit the size of its army and give official status to the Russian language, demands he has made from the outset of the conflict. Mr. Yushakov told the Business Daily Kommersant this month that Russian police and National Guard would stay in parts of Donetsk, one of the two major areas, along with Luhansk, that make up the Donbass region, even if they become a demilitarized zone under a prospective peace plan. Mr. Yushakov cautioned that trying to reach a compromise could take a long time. He said U.S. proposals that took into account Russian demands had been worsened by alterations proposed by Ukraine and its European allies. Mr. Trump has been somewhat receptive to Mr. Putin's demands, making the case that the Russian president can be persuaded to end the war if Kiev agrees to cede Ukrainian land in the Donbas region and if Western powers offer economic incentives to bring Russia back into the global economy. This story was reported by the Associated Press. Ms. Kim reported from Washington, and Ms. Morton from London. Associated Press writers Ilya Novikov in Kiev, Nicholas Riccardi in Denver, and Darlene Superville in Washington contributed to this report. Our last article comes from the Middle East. We have limited time, so I'll get right to it. The title, In Israel and Iran, Officials Talk of War. How does that suit their interest? This article was written by Shoshana Solomon, a special contributor, and Dina Kraft, special correspondent. It was published January 2nd, 2026, and the dateline is Tel Aviv, Israel, and Washington. There is a photograph at the top of the page. President Donald Trump speaks to reporters next to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu upon his arrival for meetings at Mr. Trump's Mar-a-Lago Club in Palm Beach, Florida, December 29, 2025. We do see the two gentlemen standing in front of the steps of Mar-a-Lago, which is gilded. There's gold on the walls and on the steps. And the two gentlemen are both dressed in blue suits, red ties, and white shirts, and Mr. Trump is talking into a microphone. We'll get to it. Even as Israel and Iran recover from the short but damaging June war between them, the arch foes wrapped up the old year and began the new with a flurry of warnings and threats about a potential renewed conflagration. Yet, analysts caution that both governments are beset by mounting domestic challenges, increasingly violent street protest in Iran and election year politics in post-October 7th Israel, and there's a wide gap between the government's rhetorical needs and the country's strategic interest. Meeting December 29th at President Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago Club in Palm Beach, Florida, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned that Iran's reported efforts to rebuild its ballistic missile arsenal and nuclear enrichment sites are cause for alarm, not just for Israeli interest, but for American as well. We are running out of time, so we'll wrap up the article here. Thank you for joining us for Christian Science Monitor, read by Daniel Williams.
The content featured in this recording may not reflect the views of AfterSight or the presenter. For questions, concerns, or editorial feedback regarding the Christian Science Monitor, please contact them directly at customerservice@csmonitor.com or call 617-450-2300 Monday through Friday.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.